I'm here to be a lobbyist for the palliative care community, right? That's my job. So however we can work together going forward to advance some of these priorities and take advantage of that, I think, like, I'm happy to do so. But I think, and I hear your impatience and your frustration, and I'm sure that you see it every day. So I see my work as complementary to the work that you do, and talking to healthcare providers and talking to people going through serious illness journeys, and making sure that the system that we want people to access, like, can exist and is resourced appropriately in order to make sure those things can happen.
That was Daniel Nowoselsky, Advocacy Manager for Hospice Palliative Care at the Canadian Cancer Society. In this episode, we discuss policy issues that the Canadian Cancer Society are trying to address, where his passion for palliative care stems from, and what brings Dan hope for the future.
Hi, I'm Xian Xiao.
And I'm Sammy Winemaker. We talk to people who have information and tips on how to unlock a better illness experience.
The waiting room revolution starts right now.
So, Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
So, your current role is Advocacy Manager for Hospice Palliative Care at the Canadian Cancer Society. What does that entail?
So I work at the Canadian Cancer Society, the nation's largest charity, health charity, and we cover all cancers, no matter where you live, and try to support people as best we can to take control of cancer and their experiences. I particularly work on our advocacy team. So we have lobbyists who work across the country at all levels of government to try and improve people's experience with cancer, and that's the whole gamut of the cancer, what we call the cancer control continuum. So that's things like cancer prevention, things like access to screening or diagnostics or treatment, and then I do all of our work associated with palliative care, which means I lobby the federal government and work with my colleagues in provinces and territories across the country to encourage governments to take action on these priorities and ensure improve access to care for everyone with cancer, but also, in the downstream impacts, especially when we talk about palliative care. We know with people with cancer generally have better access than most when it comes to palliative care. But so we do try to make sure that the system works better for everyone who might need access to it in terms of supporting them improve their quality of life through wherever their journey is going to take them with a serious illness.
That's a good spiel.
Thank you.
Actually, the two of you met recently when Sammy was giving a talk to the Palliative Care Coalition of Canada. I think that's made up of over 30 national organizations like the Canadian Cancer Society. They all have a role in providing palliative care. I wasn't at the meeting, but Sammy, I know you gave a talk. What did you say to healthcare leaders like Dan?
What I was trying to do is really just say that maybe we should just think about palliative care as just really good care, good medicine, and infuse that back into the patient journey, not necessarily labeling it, but instead of palliative care being a force that keeps the other care on track, that maybe what we really need to do is look at what's going wrong in the other care that's causing people to feel less like a person and, and end up in our care at the end feeling very mixed up and bamboozled. So really, to me, palliative care is not an approach to care that starts at the beginning of a diagnosis in a small way and snowballs over time. The ethos of palliative care should be the foundation of all care, which is focusing on person-centered holistic care, focusing on quality of life, and focusing on mortality awareness. And we don't have to label it anything but that. So, well, how did it land?
Yeah, so I think it landed pretty well for me, and what I appreciated was that the thought about that integration, and I do really agree with that perspective, because I think one of the challenges that we see in our healthcare system about that person-centered care, we all talk about person-centered care, we all talk about breaking down silos and making it more interdisciplinary, and I think that people, especially politicians, forget to like don't realize that palliative care is already doing that, and so a lot of the lessons they could be learning in integrating into our healthcare system, like palliative care folks are ready to teach that, integrate that system. There's a lot that they could learn from in terms of identifying solutions in there. So I think there's a lot of linkages. I think there's a lot of focus on, you know, the definition of what, how you are framing that of like, does that mean we have to be less specialized in terms of that support? And I think there's a challenge in there of making sure that there are folks equipped to then train folks going forward. And I think that's going to be a major challenge. And the other challenge that we have, especially in moving towards a more data-based system for healthcare, ideally we want to talk about evidence-informed, but unfortunately what that means in terms of data, especially when we talk about palliative care, is someone has to have a box marked palliative in order to track it. And so I think we still have to think about how to understand the system and measure the system, and especially if we're going to keep moving in a quantifiable direction in terms of health data, how to then measure palliative care if it's not just a box that we check at some point. And like an ideal system, it is better integrated throughout it. But when we still don't, there's so much we don't measure or know about how palliative care is delivered in Canada. I think there's a challenge there in figuring out how we're going to keep making the business case for support in palliative care and support for that integration across the someone's healthcare journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like what you want to measure is you want to ask the patient and the caregivers, you know, was the care that you received congruent with your values? Or do you feel you had good information about your illness in a proactive manner? Do you feel like you recognized yourself along your journey? Like, those are the things we probably want to measure, right? But yeah, it's hard to measure those things for sure. But but what we're seeing at the end is a whole bunch of people who are feeling reduced to their illness or their organ or a number or a bed, and not recognizing themselves anymore. And it's causing a lot of suffering and amplification of symptoms. So something's got to change. And
yeah, and I do feel that needle moving when I talk to elected officials. I think there's still some challenges that we do face. One example is I was speaking to a decision maker who happened to be a cancer survivor, and she was saying, like, I'm listening to what you're saying, but my experience was I always got mad walking to the oncology ward at my hospital because it was across the hall from the palliative care ward. And I didn't want to be reminded that I was going to die or I could have died. When I asked for mental health support, because me and my family are having difficulty coping, it was someone from the palliative care team. And I didn't want to speak to them because it was just a reminder that I could die. I could, as in their words, lose my fight. And so even though you're explaining to me that palliative care is about so much more than that, like, I still have this visceral feeling when you say those words to me of just that anger that, like, I didn't want to be reminded that I could die. And so there is this decoupling that is happening, that as people better understand palliative care, like, the needle is moving. I think going back to the earlier discussion about how do we get to the place where people understand that palliative care is part of the solution to these challenges in the healthcare healthcare system, that it has bigger upstream impacts, better integrating palliative care into our system. And as a result, that's how we're going to get out of the crisis feelings that we're experiencing in our ERs and with lack of access to family doctors.
And so what are the kinds of things that you see, what are the policy issues that you see on the horizon that Canadian Cancer Society and the Palliative Care Coalition of Canada are really trying to message about and prioritize?
So a big challenge that we are seeing is the lack of understanding around palliative care data. We undertook a report, the Canadian Cancer Society, to count, among other things, compare the gaps in services across the country, but also count the number of hospice beds, because we didn't even, like, CIHI didn't even have a number for how many hospice beds there were. And if we're not tracking where those beds are, how can we say that there are additional gaps to address that? So there's about 1,500 hospice beds in Canada. And when we looked at the research there was a number of different, there were a bunch of different numbers, but we kind of pointed to a Canadian example of there should be about 7 beds per 100,000 people. That was something from the Auditor General report and things like that. So if you only have 1,500 in a population of 40 million people, that means we should probably have about 2,800 beds. We only have about half about what we need. So we need to, in trying to identify some of these data gaps and close some of them, we're hoping to make sure people better understand, governments better understand the need to invest and build more in this space. I would say on top of that, the other data area or the other policy area that I think is really needs to be talked about more is health human resources. We certainly see these challenges across the country. And governments are taking steps to address that in different ways. Like we're looking at international recruitment or how do we get recognition faster? How do we increase the number of trained staff? There's certainly a lot of work to do in this area, but we're not seeing governments take up palliative care as part of that solution. So how do we make sure palliative care and trained staff who specialize in palliative care, but if we're going to entrain new workers and people joining the medical system is something that we talked about, Sammy, like mm-hmm. if we're going to have new doctors and new nurses trained, how are we integrating the palliative approach to care into that training and equip them to deliver it early on or know when to refer, when to engage palliative care specialist services better and not too late in order to improve that integration throughout the system. I think the last big challenge is that Canada doesn't do a great job with research in palliative care. It's hard to say that any jurisdiction does a great job in this space, but Canada doesn't have dedicated funding really for palliative care research. There's some initial projects that are getting off the ground, which are great, but there's a lot more work to do in terms of dedicated funding towards research in that area, and in particular for grief and bereavement.
And then the other challenge, I guess, I'm thinking about is how to do the incredible work that you're talking about, Daniel, which is amazing, how can we, it's the age old problem, Daniel, really, of the word palliative and mm-hmm. the various ways people receive that word and digest that word, metabolize that word. And it is forever getting muddled and in between us and improving the care from every level, including policy and advocacy and right at the bedside. So I return to this idea of what would it look like to think about how to improve the illness journey right from the beginning without necessarily trying to retrofit palliative care into it. But then how do you package what I'm talking about, which seems much more nebulous, right? It's more nebulous to say, we need to infuse whole person care, patient-centeredness and quality of life. You know, what do you call that? You know, well, it's the reason why most of us went into healthcare and, you know, why is it missing from the care cadence and rhythm? Anyway, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, it sounds amazing what you're saying, but it still feels like we are needing to work countercurrent mm-hmm. to the system instead of finding a way to flow with the current somehow, like just changing, mm-hmm. like taking all the experience and expertise that we have and finding a crack that we can come through that doesn't seem like it's kicking us in the butt every time. I don't know.
Yeah. So some easy questions to work from. Yeah. So I would say there's a few things. So one, I think, as you know, like I it's not an either or question when it comes to, I think, palliative care of like, do we support caregivers more or do we support, do we get more physical spaces for patients? Like supporting patients better supports caregivers and vice versa. So I don't mm-hmm. necessarily think those are either or, is an either or question. I think mm-hmm. it's a both and, but recognizing resources are scarce. I would say is like, we know the majority of Canadians want to be at home. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily mean it works best for everyone. And so mm-hmm. I do think we need people to have options and then understand access to to them in their communities. And I think there are certain gaps, even when we talk about geography in Ontario, like even in the city of Toronto, there's no hospice east of the Don River, or in like there's no hospice in Northwestern Ontario. There are big geographic gaps where if someone wanted access to those services, they couldn't get access to it. So I do think we need to address those things. But certainly we need to couple that with giving people real choices if they want to be at home and get that support. Like, certainly that's not widely available across the country, much less in ways that are culturally specific to your needs or people understand it. Like, there's still people in the, like, certainly people in this country without a home. So even home care is not necessarily an option in that case. So there are different gaps that we need, and we need to make sure that the full suite of options are available to people, regardless of where they live and what setting they choose to receive care. I think it's important to have that comprehensive understanding and have that, and like, as you talk about in the book, about having those conversations with your families early on in your care journey, and have an advanced care plan in place to guide you and where you want to be, and have those conversations early on in people's illness trajectories in order to make sure that those care needs are actually being properly met.
So Dan, besides advocacy, what's an example of work Canadian Cancer Society is doing to improve the experience of patients and families facing advanced cancer?
I think we're in the word palliative care and the scariness of it and then integration. We launched an ad campaign earlier this year. It's still online at cancer.ca/palliative care. We called it About Life, and we talked about people's palliative care journeys and telling stories about that. The goal of the campaign was not just to like demystify what palliative care is, but talk to people about what palliative care gives them. It's not just that it reduces suffering, or not just that it manages pain. It's like, we told the story of Bonnie, who was able to receive care at home, as a result could play with her grandkids and could get art therapy at home. And those are the things she got from that experience. There was a kid named Ollie, whose story we told. He was diagnosed with leukemia, and the palliative care support gave his family a lot of comfort in guiding through that journey, but also helped them adapt when he lost his vision as a result of his cancer treatment. And so now he gets to skateboard as a result of that support the palliative care gives. I think the word palliative care is scary because that means the end for so many people. And we have to talk more about what palliative care gives people and what benefits you get from it, rather than talking about the ways it makes a hard thing less hard. Like, it gives people a lot and gives people satisfaction. I know when I was caring for my dad at home through his final days, like, having that support and being able to have those conversations through that, it meant that I knew that I was doing exactly what he needed and he wanted. And we didn't have to have those questions or that wondering of like, am I making the right decision by keeping him at home? Am I making the right decision by having a PSW come in, even though it's the pandemic? Like, we could have those conversations together because we had that guidance to kind of walk through those conversations. And that was extremely valuable and something that I'm happy that I could take from that experience. So I think that I don't think the problem is the word. The problem is the feeling that people get when they hear the word. And I think we just need to navigate how we can change the conversation around those feelings, rather than worrying about, because whatever word we choose will have those negative feelings associated with it. We have to change how we make people feel when they hear that word.
I mean, it's clear that you have a passion for this topic. And so, you know, where did that passion come from?
That's a great question. You know, it is hard for me to articulate a specific point because I think it's been so ingrained in how I was raised. My grandfather passed away when I was just after my 15th birthday from Parkinson's, complications due to Parkinson's, I should say. And then when almost a decade later, I lost a grandmother to Lewy body dementia. And each of those moments and those diagnoses like radically changed my family in a lot of ways. We had to all, you know, dropped everything to become caregivers and whatever iteration of that in that relationship. So caring's always been part of my understanding of what it means to love someone and be a part of a family. And like, my family had always been open and talking about illness and death and how we would handle it. So then in the pandemic, my dad, he had had a couple of health issues for a while, but he developed a rare condition called hepatopulmonary syndrome. I can provide a magic school bus level explanation of what it is. That's about as far as I can go. But basically, the way his liver was malfunctioning meant that his red blood cells were dilating, and they were acting as if they were full of oxygen. So when they go to his lungs, they wouldn't absorb the right level of oxygen, and they wouldn't be able to bring it to the rest of his body. So his muscles couldn't move. He would have difficulty breathing and things along those lines. But it only seems to really affect people when they're standing up and if he was lying down, he was fine. So it took a while to get that diagnosis, and especially this was all in June and July 2020. So peak pandemic, where respirologists and other healthcare professionals weren't necessarily ready available to treat him or diagnose him. And so that created additional challenges as well. By the time we figured out that that's what was affecting him, the recommended course of treatment was a double lung and liver transplant, but because of his age and other health issues, there was no way that that was going to be feasible. So, you know, he went from doing a full round of golf in May and June 2020, once the golf courses reopened due to COVID, to barely being able to make it down the stairs at Christmas and passing away in February 2021. So caring for him when he couldn't necessarily stand up or he would lose oxygen was quite challenging. Things like getting dressed, bathing, all of those challenges became quite difficult. And then on top of that, it was during the pandemic. So letting other people inside our home or my home, figuring out, you know, how his family could be there, trying to get to medical appointments. It was always funny to me going into a hospital and they'd ask the COVID screening questions of like, are you having difficulty breathing? Yes, that's why we're here. Like, it was always a very interesting challenge in navigating that. Being able to spend, you know, a few days a week with them and helping my dad through that journey, it was a really profound experience for me. And then it was at the time that Ontario was doing their framework on palliative care. So I took that project on for CCS. I was mostly focused on advocacy just in Ontario at that time. And afterward, we restructured our team and there was this opportunity to do palliative care work full time. And I kind of took that on and ran with it within our team. And I've been in this role now for 2.5 years. And I absolutely love the experience and love the amazing people I get to work with in the palliative care community. I don't have a healthcare background. So it's just, it's really just, I've fallen in love with this experience and the people I've gotten to meet. And I can't imagine my life without this particular experience now as a result of that work.
Your passion is very obvious. We can feel it through the screen, which is amazing. You're in the right role for sure.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Hey, listeners, you're halfway through the episode. We want to remind you that our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, is available anywhere you buy books. Did you know you can leave a review on Amazon without purchasing directly from Amazon? All you need is an account. Reviews help others find our book when they need it most. Thanks for your support, and lots more of this great episode left, so keep listening.
You know, in the most ironic way, Dan, COVID was such an oddity. Of course, we all know that, but there were families that stepped up in so many different ways. I mean, you described how you had to go, you know, at this from a different angle to get your dad what he needed. But there was this feeling, because of course I care for people in their homes, that families, they stepped up. Like, they didn't want to put their loved one in a facility. Many were busting their loved ones out of long-term care, bringing them home. And they were scared, like you said, of having nurses and PSWs and different people coming into their home. So it's like sink or swim. And unfortunately, some of them sank, but many of them swam. Many of them became, you know, even more the care team and more creative and more, you know, organized around their person. So in a way, they sort of by necessity had to become more activated in their person's care because they were bubbling together. Now there's all these horrible stories too, but just that was part of the thread of your story that I was listening to, which was how you had to take it upon yourself. And there was some protection in that for your father, right?
Yeah. And I hear what you're saying about that. And certainly I never felt closer to my dad or closer to my mom and my sister going through that experience. It was incredibly, but I also like, we're lucky that we could do that. We were lucky that we could accomplish that and that we could get through it that period in that the way that we did. There's so many people who, even with all the privileges in the world, aren't that lucky and aren't able to do it. And it's not that they're not trying hard enough or they're not, you know.
But I have something to share. Okay, you might be surprised by this. Absolutely. And I think you're right, generally, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, having cared for people for all these years, I used to play this game with myself, like, what are the ingredients that need to be in place so that I can predict who's going to pull this off at home or not? You know, and at first glance, you think, okay, well, it's got to be about education level. It's got to be about socioeconomic status. It's got to be about, you know, all these privileged things, right? And I realized that that is not the case. I mean, those things might help in some scenarios, but it is about having a person in your life, a person who is willing and able to stick it out with you, ideally more than one person. And, you know, I've seen people in the darndest situations that are not privileged. And sometimes they fare better because they were talking openly with each other. They had enough information from whatever health providers they had. They were willing and present to be able to provide the care. They had expectations that were congruent with the scenario. And it's just really weird because that was contrasted with other situations where I would be in a more affluent part of town with, you know, many people involved and people connected to the system and backdooring things and going around corners. And those scenarios were often like absolute chaos. So I've come to realize that, you know, there's definitely privileged people. And that makes a huge difference when it comes to your health and wellness. But when it comes to caring for someone at home, you might be surprised who pulls it off and who doesn't.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think what I get concerned about when I people talk about caregiving, and you know, there's not an expectation, but an assumption that your family will be there for you. Support you through your final days. If, like, if your loved one is sick, that especially, and that often especially falls on women, on people of color, that expectation that, you know, they'll be prepared to drop everything and care for their loved one. And we were lucky that, you know, it was easy to drop things and move the needle to where I could flex my hours at work. I could do all these things that helped me to make those decisions. But that, as the system shouldn't be expecting that of people. We shouldn't.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, the reason home care succeeds so much is families are a part of it in providing that care. Should that expectation always be placed on families to provide the hours of care and the 24/7 monitoring to support people through that if they don't have capacity to do that? Or, you know, there's so many sandwich generation caregivers.
Oh, I agree with you.
Yeah, it shouldn't be the case, but.
So as you know, in the waiting room revolution, we are trying to go upstream so that the bigger picture is the focus as early on as people are ready to hear and understand, because that's the biggest opportunity to change the story.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly familiar with the work, and I'm certainly I've seen you speak a number of times. I think you've used the metaphor of the mountain of where you need to push along the journey. I see my role within CCS as my job is to push the particular part of the mountain that I know how to speak to. I fell into politics when I was 18. I spent most of my adult life working at Queen's Park in Ontario, but working in politics and speaking to politicians. So talking to decision makers in the language that they understand about why we need to move the mountain in the direction that we want it to go. But there's lots of different aspects of what the Canadian Cancer Society does in terms of information and support services. You know, we've got a helpline, we've got a forum, and I've shared your resources, but also they have a lot of other resources to help people guide through particular journeys, regardless of into survivorship, whether it's someone end of life, and how to walk caregivers through that journey as well in order to support them and have those conversations about hoping for the best and planning for the rest, or how to zoom out, how to have honest conversation, how to understand your style of how you want to receive information. Mm-hmm. All of these pieces in guiding them, I think it all works in tandem and collaboration, and we're only going to be able to move this mountain of a healthcare system if we are working at, we are working complementary to speak to our respective audiences in order to accomplish it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just feel like we are so incredible, those of us who work in palliative care in every way, including yourself. We get it. We know it. We have it going on, but I can't help but think still it's not an one or the other, but that as a resource of people who, again, are sitting on a gold mine of what really good care looks like, that I wish I could wave my magic wand and use all of us as resources to lobby for all of what we're talking about, but start at the beginning of the journey so that the rest of it falls in place. But my experience has been, you know, decades in this work is that it's still overly interpreted as improving end-of-life care. And so no matter which way we try to sell it or advocate for it, it's either about hospices, bricks and mortar, which, you know, or more beds, which is end-of-life care, or, you know, more palliative care specialty teams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just want to take all of us and learn how to lobby for this care we're talking about upstream.
I'm here to be a lobbyist for the palliative care community, right? That's my job. So however we can work together going forward to advance some of these priorities and take advantage of that, I think, like, I'm happy to do so. But I think, and I hear your impatience and your frustration, and I'm sure that you see it every day. And no, we have to keep continuing steps and take individual conversations to change the needle one step by one step at a time. I was in a meeting early on when I started this job, and I was introducing myself to this room of people with advanced cancer and a Zoom meeting of people with advanced cancer. And one guy, just in the introductions, immediately said, "I don't want to talk about palliative care at this meeting because this is about advanced cancer, and I don't want to talk about dying. I don't want to talk about losing hope." Mm-hmm. And so, you know, going into this 2-hour meeting, I was like, man, he is not going to be interested in anything I have to say. At the end of the meeting, he said, "You know what? Like, I probably shouldn't have said that, because, like, what I'm most afraid of is that I'm going to die alone and in pain. So if you're telling me palliative care can help with that, then, like, I guess we have to discuss it." And so I think it's just like the door is going to open slowly and incrementally over time. And we just have to keep pushing and have to keep walking through whatever door we find that's unlocked.
I agree. But that, in that example, that person, like, I imagine that if we were able to help that person who got cancer, whose cancer might have presented advanced, or it might have been in an earlier stage and progressed, if they were offered, you know, the option of looking at the next chapters of the what ifs, or like a long view of the cancer, you know, while we're hoping that it stays quiet or in stage 2 or 1, you know, if someone helped that person walk 2 roads, he might not show up at that visit where you were and be so, have such antibodies against, you know, his own mortality. So I think we leave people so late in the game without any discussion or invitation to them earlier, that the invitation to talk about palliative care or end of life care or dying at a point where you're already advanced and no one's invited you is like a slap in the face. Of course, what you're offering is just the best care possible. And once a person hears all about that, they want it right away. But you get what I'm saying, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, he should have been told that long before he met me on a Zoom call. Like, he's stage 3 kidney cancer. He'd been living with kidney cancer for, I think, 3 or 4 years by that point. Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely. But the next best time was that day, right? The next best time is the first time he has that conversation. So, we have to keep taking, like,
meet people where they're at.
Meet people where they're at. And also keep, even though it feels like it's the same conversation over and over again, we have to keep having it because that is the only way we're going to open.
But I resent to get there. That we're the first ones.
Absolutely. And that's I can't imagine being the person who has to deliver that as a care provider. I joked when I took this job of like, just when things are opening back up, going to parties again for the first time, I'm going to tell everyone I work in palliative care. Like, I made a lot of jokes about that. But it also is amazing to me the number of people that are just saying, like, my relative or whatever has a serious illness. I have difficulty walking through it, and just have an open conversation because this is the first time someone's talked about that openly with them in a social setting, and the first time they felt comfortable in having that. So we are making a difference in people's lives. We are making that change.
And that's the irony, right? Like, that's the irony is that, well, first of all, I never get tired of having these conversations over and over and over and over and over again, because I see how healing they are. What I get upset about is the fact that this person has made many life decisions, and they have made them in a rabbit hole without really someone or teams guiding them through the bigger picture. So we're okay to keep doing what we're doing. It's a beautiful profession. It's a beautiful way of approaching life and health and illness. But it's not okay that people are left until they meet us to make them feel human again. That part's not okay, especially when so many people are interested in assisted dying, which I fully support. But, you know, it's a whole different way of looking at your options. If you have all the information you need in the various chapters of your illness, so that it doesn't feel like, you know, you have either fake information or half information, or you don't have any information, and then you're so scared that you'd rather just pull the plug, you know? So I love what we do. I can see you love what we do.
Yeah.
But we are meeting still. I am meeting the same people, Daniel, over, it's not my city, it's not my area where I work, the same people over and over and over again with the same issues, which is why Sian and I wrote this book. And so that part is disheartening. Not the actual care is beautiful, but it's disheartening that they're still coming down the pipeline like that.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of work to do to change the system and to move in that, move in the direction in which they're facing it. I think even voices around the table, like there's often a lot of my palliative care conversations, the long-term care folks aren't present. The folks doing leadership and long-term care.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to look at how we integrate in that. And there's new federal standards that are voluntary that they put out, but it actually had palliative care language. It had a standard definition for like advanced care planning and having those things integrated into that. So I think we'll get to, I think we are starting to move to a place where other leaders and other parts of our healthcare system are starting to get it. I think it's my job to keep talking to decision makers and moving that. It's also my job to keep talking to other disease groups, like the Canadian Cancer Society, other associations who support people through that. And I'm very lucky to work with the Canadian Society of Palliative Care Physicians. Leah does an amazing job in reaching out to other specialty medical providers and making sure that specialists are better equipped to have those conversations. And we need to make sure that there's when we're having conversations, encouraging people to talk about palliative care, that there's resources equipped, like there's education and training readily available for them to deliver that care, that if people want to be referred somewhere or to have a conversation, whether that's, you know, specific psychosocial support or spiritual support, there are providers ready to help them through that journey and beyond their family care provider, whoever the specialist that they're speaking to. So I think it's making sure that we are having these conversations, that people are equipped, frontline healthcare providers are equipped to have those conversations, but also equipped to know where to go, where to refer people, to make sure that the specific support that each person needs is available and readily present for them to get there. So I think we're And when we're talking all around the same, I think we have the same vision for what a healthcare system is. And
definitely.
I think we,
it's semantics.
Yeah. And I think our decision makers are, we have to make sure that we're having this conversation in front of them in order to make sure that they hear us and mm-hmm. understand when we say like a palliative, integrated palliative approach to care in our system, what that means is the things that they talk about when they say we want a person-centered approach to care, that mm-hmm. we want a care without silos, that in difficulty accessing different specialists that are mm-hmm. interdisciplinary from the beginning, that we have care that is connected to the community and their families and their mm-hmm. loved ones, that they can mm-hmm. stay at home if they want to, mm-hmm. they can be in a hospice if they want to. We're going to get, we are moving in that direction. Yeah. It's nowhere near fast enough.
We're talking about the same, we are both talking about the same thing coming from it from different angles. That's what we're doing. Yeah. But you're right. We're talking about our ultimate vision is the same.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's just making sure that, you know, we are speaking in the way that other people hear us.
Yeah.
So Dan, we sometimes end our interviews with a question about the future. So what mm-hmm. brings you hope for the future?
I think that's it's a really interesting question to ask right now, because I think there are a lot of big challenges that we see in this like big transformation of our healthcare system, but also the change in how our politics operates and things like that. What gives me hope is honestly speaking to other palliative care providers and learning mm-hmm. from them and learning their stories and experiences, because like it is possible to make people's difficult times easier. It is possible to make give people that sense of closure and satisfaction that good palliative care can provide. There is a way to hold people's hands through like these life-changing moments, like a cancer diagnosis or diagnosis of anything else. And so hearing people deliver that care and do that every day, that's what gives me hope that, you know, change is possible, that mm-hmm. these things, even if it's not happening soon enough or fast enough, it can happen. It will happen. Mm. And if we keep moving in that direction, I think I also see a lot of people who work day in and day out at the local level in their communities to get people gathered around, whether it's a hospice or providing home care through a visiting hospice program or other support, and other volunteers who participate in that work. And I think if those communities can get mobilized around this issue at the local level, we can mm-hmm. see a world in which it changes at the provincial and federal level too, and internationally around the world. So I see these the seeds of this change growing, and I hope we can continue to water them collectively mm-hmm. in order to make sure that they keep growing from here.
You know what? I really love what you just said about, okay, maybe it's not happening fast enough and maybe there's a lot to fix, but the fact that it can happen, that you can heal, you know, someone in these different scenarios is pretty incredible, right? Mm-hmm. And I would agree with you, but I like how you frame that, because I'm gonna think about that too. Like the fact that, for example, you know, a person like myself can go in and someone is in so having, you know, they're suffering so much, and you bring yourself and you are the best medicine you offer a patient and family, and you can see how much it makes a difference. The fact that that works is very hopeful. Mm-hmm. It's very hopeful. We just have to figure out how the rest of the system can figure out how to do it as well, right? Mm-hmm. It would be less hopeful if we said, okay, there's nothing we can do at this point too. I mean, you know, we can't change this, but we do change it for people. So that's a beautiful thing. I like that message.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for all that you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's great. I think I love getting to hear you guys speak. I love the work that you're doing. So,
thank you.
I can't wait to see you at every other palliative care conference I'm going to see you at in the next year.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah.
No, hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Visit our website, waitingroomrevolution.com, for more information, to join our newsletter, and to check out our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest. This podcast is produced by myself, Kayla McMillan, Shilpa Jyothi Kumar, and Maggie Sivek. And our theme music is Maypole by Ketsa.